Welcome to Black Boys and Men, Changing the Narrative, a podcast series sponsored by the McSilver Institute for Poverty Policy and Research at the NYU Silver School of Social Work and the Community Technical Assistance Center of New York. I'm your host, Jason Jones. This series brings together thought leaders, community members, and individuals with lived experience to discuss and dispel the myths and stereotypes surrounding Black boys and men, while providing facts and best practices for those working with these often marginalized populations. Today's podcast will highlight some of the prominent myths regarding Black boys in schools and expand upon the best practices to close the achievement gap. We're joined by Dr. Ivory Toldson, the President and CEO of the Quality Education for Minorities Network, Professor of Counseling Psychology at Howard University, and Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Negro Education. Prior to his work with the QEM Network, Dr. Toldson was appointed by President Barack Obama to serve as the Executive Director of the White House Initiative on Historically Black Colleges and Universities. Dr. Toldson, thanks for joining us. Let's start by hearing a little bit more about you and the work that you do.
Right now, I'm the president of the Quality Education for Minorities Network, the QEM Network, and we're a nonprofit that advances STEM education for underrepresented minorities, primarily through work with minority-serving institutions. I'm also a professor at Howard University, and I've conducted quite a bit of research on looking at achievement and motivation among historically marginalized students in a variety of different learning contexts, with a special emphasis on African-American males.
And from my understanding, the QEM Network has a national reach, impacting students throughout the country. Can you speak about the work of the organization?
So we provide technical assistance to faculty members at minority-serving institutions to help them build their research agenda and to compete more successfully for federal governments to advance their research and programs. We also work directly with students through our internship program. We have a summer internship program in partnership with the National Science Foundation, where we recruit students from historically disadvantaged backgrounds to bring them to Washington, D.C., and assign them to work with professionals over at the National Science Foundation. And they also work with us on a series of learning strategies, seminars, webinars that help to advance their professional development, as well as inspire them to pursue graduate study beyond their baccalaureate degree.
That all sounds incredible and quite comprehensive. So just getting into the topic, from your understanding as well as your expertise, what would you say are the biggest myths regarding the academic achievement of Black boys and men in this country?
I think the biggest myth overall is that the problems that we are seeing with their performance in school is something based on either them or their culture or their community, and not a problem of the system. So a lot of the work that I've done is to help to expose the system for certain practices, like underfunding certain schools, using redlining to divert resources to a school that has one population of students and to reduce the resources that another population of students is getting, using biases about a student culture and abilities to deny their access to higher level classes like calculus and physics and trigonometry. So there's an overall myth that performances due to more internal are challenges within that's fixed within who they are. And I can get into some of the specific myths that have spawned from that, if you want me to.
Oh, please do. We'd love to hear more about these.
So a lot of myths come from the families, are the way that their families are viewed. There's a myth that children from a single-parent household is at a disadvantage academically. And the research that I've done, where I've looked at large data sets, some of them were specifically designed to understand the family, does not show a significant difference between the achievement levels of someone who comes from a single-parent household versus a two-parent household. And in fact, it's really the characteristics of the parents, like whether or not the parent has education, a higher level of education themselves. It has to do with the parents' practices, parenting practices, the parents' tendency to give more love and support to the child, cooperative relationships between parents when they're not living together, and also the parents' expectations of the child and interaction with the school. So when we use a myth like, you know, just whether or not there are two parents in the household to predict, to make negative predictions or assumptions about the child's aptitude, our ability to achieve, then we end up denying a lot of children the proper education before they've even gotten started.
Of course. And I feel like many of these myths really have to do with these systemic injustices that you really pointed out. One of them that I think is particularly interesting is this notion that many Black males are automatically slated to go to prison. And we're talking about the school to prison pipeline in many ways, predicting how many young Black boys will be imprisoned within their life. And I know that from some of your work, you've identified that as a myth as well.
Yeah, so there are problems associated with an overrepresentation of Black males in the juvenile justice system. You know, that is not a myth. There are problems associated with achievement. Problems come in when researchers and pundits and social commentators try to integrate what's going on in the juvenile justice system with the schools, and they make the assumption that if we deal with at-risk children, then we're somehow inadvertently giving them a better academic experience. And you know, a lot of times when we have this view that young Black males, just by virtue of them being a Black male, is at risk for the criminal justice system, we end up devising strategies in school where their only aim is to keep a child from the juvenile justice system. Now, that's not a very lofty goal. A lofty goal would be to give them the type of curriculum and environment that's going to spur their interest in going to college or help them to think about what kind of careers they want to have. That's going to give them a love of learning and help them to have experiential experiences. Some of the same things that we see in some of the schools that don't have high percentage of Black and brown kids who have a lot of students that going into college. So when we think about young Black males as the other that is in need of some kind of specialized attention based on their propensity to act out in ways that make them more vulnerable to the criminal justice system, then a lot of times we end up not structuring their education in a way that really suits the needs of students who just really need a quality education.
Right. And I think what's interesting about that is that we're not catering services to all students. We're really catering to certain types of students and hoping that everyone fits within that mold.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that has helped me to really understand young Black males better is to really talk to them and to understand what are some of the things that's challenging about their experience. And when you talk with them, you realize they're just as hungry for a quality education as anybody else. They just want a school that respects them. They want a school that where the teachers treat them with a level of dignity, and where they could have a type of holistic learning experiences. They don't want to be in an environment where they have to walk through metal detectors every day, and where their lockers are searched randomly. They don't want to be in this overly punitive environment. And you know, a lot of times when we think about the school to prison pipeline, we do think about discipline. Discipline is something that we really do need to think about. The way that we structure a lot of schools where they're being disciplined disproportionately more harshly than they would if they were in a different type of school environment.
If, you know, someone were to ask you, so what are the facts regarding Black male achievement in schools within the country? What are things that we're not talking about but are actually happening within the schools that are positives?
I think that, you know, if you want to know the right thing to do, you have to look at success stories. And I think that there are some examples out there, you know, examples like Urban Prep in Chicago and the Eagle Academy in New York, where they have had a positive agenda for the students and they receive positive outcomes. You know, one of the things I found in my Breaking Barriers report is that when you look at success factors, you know, if you look within the population of young Black males as opposed to doing a comparative analysis, where all you're doing is comparing them to white students, you find more rich information if you're looking within. So if I were to take young Black males who are doing well in school and compare them to young Black males who are not doing so well in school, then you have a better chance of finding the things that are applicable to the success of those that we want to help. And, you know, some of the things I found in the Breaking Barriers report were things like health habits, like promoting students getting a good night's sleep and having a proper diet at school, helping them to understand the value of positive social relationships, different things like that was associated with young Black males doing well in school. Also looking at family relationships, looking at positive learning environments in the household, and parents who treated their children with love and respect and that complimented them frequently, building up their esteem, and that promoted a college-going culture. You know, that was associated with young Black males doing well in school, having the appropriate amount of community resources and extracurricular activities at the school. Young Black males who were involved in the extracurricular activity at the school were more likely to do well in school. So, you know, that just becomes an easy thing for schools to do. You know, take a homeroom survey, assess how many children at the school are participating in any extracurricular activity. And if you have low participation, then it's time to revise some clubs and organizations. It's time to, you know, have presentations in the classroom, identify student leaders. Some of the student leaders may be the same students who get in trouble, but they're not being stimulated, and so you create leaders out of them. And then with respect to the school, what I found with the Breaking Barriers reports was that the relationship with a teacher was very important, and that young Black males wanted the types of relationship with their teachers that was based on mutual respect and agency. They didn't want a teacher that just, you know, knew the material, but they wanted a teacher that treated them as a person. They also wanted a school that they could connect to their future. They wanted to understand what was going on in their classrooms and how what they were learning in school connected to a positive outcome for their future. So none of these things are, you know, is rocket science, but it's things that we don't really talk about as much as we should.
And I think what's interesting about that Breaking Barriers report is that it truly takes into account the opinions and perspectives of the young Black men that are within these classrooms, specifically asking them, what do you want to see from your schools? What would best support you? And I think that that's something that's often missing from the discussion in terms of actually asking the population, how can we best serve you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that really was an eye-opening experience for me was when I was working in the prison and an inmate came to my office and he just talked about the power of seeing someone like me with the kind of position that I had. And he said that growing up, he didn't see many people that looked like me. And he ended what he was saying with the line, talk to the kids. He said, what I really came here to do was tell you to talk to the kids. And, you know, talking to the kids has been something that has resonated with me and something that I've used to really enlighten my mission. When I was writing the Breaking Barriers report, and I was also judging a writing contest for young Black males at the same time, I found a lot of congruity and synergy between what I was finding from statistical analysis and what some of the young Black men were saying. There were a lot of lines that I used from their essays in the Breaking Barriers report. One of them that stuck with me was, what about to be seen as a person with a name been poof, a statistic, a memory, and to many, a shame? Basically, what he was talking about was how a lot of stats are just driven at them, but he wants to be seen as a person with a name, not a statistic. And there was also one that said being a black man is a blessing that people have tried to make a curse. And, you know, of course, you know, reading things like that made me very sensitive to the types of ways in which we talk about young black males. At the same time, I was reading a young black man saying being a black man is a blessing that people tried to make a curse. I'm seeing social advocates who are on the same team as me going to these schools saying there are more black men in prison than in college. You know, these are things that young black males who are trying to figure out life, trying to figure out how they're going to prepare for the ACT or trying to figure out if college is even for them, trying to figure out how they're going to learn how to apply to college when nobody in their family has ever gone to college. They're trying to figure out these types of things. And the only thing we could do is give them all these statistics about the likelihood that they're going to fail. You know, a lot of times when we get on our soapboxes, we really don't do it with these young black men in mind, but they are listening to us. And I think another thing that has made it difficult for the field to really do what's in the best interest of a lot of young black males is because of the dominance of objective research. The Breaking Bad report was both objective and subjective. It was objective in the fact that there was large data sets that was used. There was statistical analysis that was conducted. There was test of significance that was performed. But it was subjective in the fact that there were essays from young black males who was used to better inform the research. There was a researcher who was not shy about using his own personal experiences of being a young black male and his observations to place the research in its proper context. There needs to be more research that's conducted that blends what we know about good statistics and rigorous research with a good subjective understanding of what's going on in these communities.
What's interesting about what you said is the impact that you had as an individual, as a black man, on another, them just seeing you within that position. And I'm wondering about the notion of increasing the number of black men who are teachers. Do you think that that could help with engaging boys in schools at all?
Yes, but the way that we often describe the contributions of young black male teachers, I think, is disconnected from their true usefulness. A lot of times we look at young black male teachers as surrogate fathers, people that we position in the school in order to save the most troubled kids. They become a part of the bad narrative that we use for bad strategies. So when you have young black male teachers in the school and you decide that you're going to take a young black male with serious emotional problems, with trauma, and a lot of things that they need to deal with that's beyond the capabilities of a teacher that's serving all of these students, and you're putting these students in the black male class just because they're a black male, is treating the issue very superficially. Now, the reason why young black males are important in the classroom is because of their contribution to the profession, not just their contribution to individual students. So they should be involved in the interprofessional dialogue. They should be used as a resource to help all teachers do a better job with teaching all students. And every school should have as a policy that students are never assigned based on their race or gender, that the assignment is always random, and that every teacher, regardless of their race or gender, has the capability to teach any student regardless of their race or gender.
So we talked a lot about what specific schools can do in terms of engaging black boys. What do you think we need to be doing on the policy level?
So on the policy level, we need to do a better job of connecting our strategies to research. So some of the things that I discussed earlier, like having extracurricular activities in school, a lot of our policies deal with testing. And a lot of the results from tests drive policies. But we really don't have any research evidence that good performance on the test is connected with any positive life outcome, even success in college. You know, we just don't have the data to support that. But we do have research evidence that participation in extracurricular activities connects students more to the school and they end up doing better in school. But a lot of the policies that I see involve reducing the investments in extracurricular activities in the arts, in clubs, in sports, and increasing the investment in test prep. And a lot of that money goes to external consultants and contractors, and it takes money away from things that would help the students have more enriching experiences. So that's a policy that really needs to be addressed. Discipline policy needs to be examined. All the things involved with the zero tolerance disciplinary policies, the types of searches, security guards in the school. I visited a school in New York, and they had to have about 6 security guards at the school, and the security guard at the entrance did not know who the principal was. You know, I asked the security guard for the principal by name, and the security guard who was searching bags coming to the school did not know who the principal was. Some of the practices are actually pretty absurd. It's absurd to think that, you know, you stick a, you know, NYPD in front of the school and don't give them any type of specialized training in dealing with school issues, and to have them so arrogantly feel like all they have to do is search bags and not even understand who the leaders at the school is, not even be in a position to be a servant. If you don't know who the principal of the school is, you can't really serve the school effectively. So the discipline policies definitely need to be looked at. The testing policies need to be addressed. We should not be teaching to the test. We should be accommodating multiple types of learning, giving kids multiple types of experiences. I think that, you know, a lot of the policies are common sense, but, you know, practice-wise, for some reason, people who are making some very serious decisions don't seem to be getting it.
And with that, Dr. Tolton, I'd like to thank you so much for your expertise, for really delving into this topic with us and giving us some things that we can improve upon within everyday practice, but also some policy implications that we can address. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
As always, thanks for joining us. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, our presenter, Dr. Ivory Tolton, and our producer, Brianna Gonzalez. To learn more about our work and to check out some of our resources, visit mcsilver.nyu.edu and ctacny.org. Until next time, this is Jason Jones, and we are changing the narrative together.